chihuahua who looks a scream. Hand him on my whoa. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Hi, you are listening to KBOO FM, and this is Art Focus with guest host Kristen Derryberry. Today we are speaking with David Eckert. The current show, Placards and Placeholders, is up now until February 15th at PCC Sylvania's Northview Gallery. Gallery hours are from 8 to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday and 11 to 4 p.m. on Saturday. So, hi.
Hi.
So, I would like to first introduce you to our listeners through talking about your process of sculpture and object making and how it relates to performance and vice versa.
Okay, great. Yeah. First of all, thank you for having me in to talk about this show. It's funny, it's been a sort of transformative, you know, arc of work. I initially started doing pieces that really inferred use or function. They were based off the body, like, you know, mid-90s, late-90s work. So you'd look at them and you couldn't help but have some sort of kinesthetic bounce with them. Oh, they strap here, they rest here, they, you know, they do these different things, you know, directly linked to the body. And I remember being really, really hesitant about letting anybody do anything with them, even myself. I had dancers and photographers always, let's do a shoot, let's use these as props. And I was really, just carried this belief of like, no, they're objects, they're untouchable, they just need to sit there and do their thing. And then kind of had a little breakthrough with some smaller little performances, and then eventually started to build specific objects for very specific performance events, like Scribe and Podium, and then went down the river with Float. And I realized that that was okay. By performing the objects, they didn't disappear. They had another sort of history attached to them. And then, you know, the performance slips in and out of my practice, and just the last couple of years I've been really interested in, you know, building works that still have that sort of implied use or function or application, but not actually, you know, performing them to let the viewer do a little bit more of the work and sort of kind of break down, you know, continue to try to break down a certain passivity looking at the work. Works like, I was realizing that when I was occupying the pieces or deploying the pieces or using the pieces, there was a certain step back. Oh, now I see what this is. Now I see what he's doing. I really enjoy the throwing out the riddle or the prompt for somebody else. It's like, well, what do you, I mean, sometimes it seems a little snarky. Well, what do you think it is? But at the same time, you know, there's an interesting exchange that happens to make the person that's looking at the work actually have to do the sort of theatrics in their head of like, what would this be? How do I do it? And then all of a sudden, all the dynamics that exist around that kind of exchange, you know, kind of flare up, sexual, political, personal, social, all those sort of things.
Yeah. Thank you. How do you decide your materials at first? Like, do you go in having a piece kind of already in your mind of what you want, or does the material come first?
It's a little bit of both, but I mean, over the years I've pretty much set myself with a pretty consistent, you know, material base, and I like using materials that are pretty, you know, generic, you know, pretty pedestrian, you know, wood, steel, leather, fabric. I mean, it's funny, when I do labeling or notations, it's always the same: painted wood, steel, leather, fur, wool, fur, lace, you know, all these sort of different things. And I think there's just a kind of pragmatism to that material that, again, allows the pieces not to become these, you know, fetishized objects about craft or facility or, you know, damn, he can sew or wow, he can carve. That's not really important as much as having the materials recognizable enough, familiar enough, that the craft of the object hopefully kind of just disappears quickly. It's a given, it's convincing, it's good enough, and then the sort of secondary conversations might occur. And again, it's just over the years of doing this work, you know, I've gotten pretty competent with, you know, using the materials and been able to sort of push out a lot of alternatives with the materials. This show in particular was exciting. It's like, oh God, let's see how many materials we can kind of jam together. Let's use, you know, shiny, you know, satin material, little mirrors, painted form, steel, hair, wool, all those sort of things. And that's always a challenge for me to somehow hopefully come to a point where the piece is unified in the materials and not just some, you know, car crash, you know, Fabric Depot nightmare, you know.
Did you think it became unified in the show? Do you think it was successful in any way?
I think so. I hope so. I mean, again, quite a few of the pieces are still so fresh. I'm kind of processing them. I remember bringing them in to install. I was like, oh, is this literally still warm from the welder or still wet from the paint? But it, you know, it takes a little bit to kind of come back at them with a more objective view and really see, well, did this work or was this too excessive? I mean, usually it's the two floor pieces I was excited about because the space is so beautiful. And up to about a month or so before the show was going to open, I realized I had a lot of the floor or the wall work that kind of spilled onto the floor, you know, stayed on the vertical surfaces. But I thought, I've got to do something for that beautiful polished, you know, cement floor. And so the two floor pieces were, you know, finished maybe 3 weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago. So they're super, super fresh. And again, always, you know, the context of the gallery is so different than in my crowded studio where I can't not see everything that's in the periphery, you know, all the scraps and all the old work. And so to have the opportunity to sort of open them up and put them in this fresh space is really, really satisfying. But again, I'm still processing what was this piece that snuck up on me, you know, before the show opened. But I think I'm really excited about the exhibition, because a lot of times I've done more sort of, you know, thematic shows where they're all kind of driven by one topic or one idea. And this is just a kind of a collection of work, and hopefully each piece, you know, both stands on its own, but then there's a cross conversation between all the work. And I think that comes from, you know, repeated motifs, from, you know, repeated material choices, all those kind of factors.
Awesome.
Was that even close to answering
my question? Yes. Okay. Yes. It totally answered that question. What was the title behind the show? What was behind the title on the show?
Placards
and Placeholders. And general themes of the show before we get into specific pieces.
Yeah. Well, I've always been fascinated by like pedagogical tools, from either like from flashcards to game boards, you know, to educational, you know, devices and props and, you know, diagrams and things. Because I think there's a certain authority or truth, you know, quote unquote, that's given to these things, you know, and who owns that truth? Who owns that imagery? How is it presented? And, you know, I think of this as being a faculty member and teaching too. It's like, what tropes do I continually unearth and present? Here's my image. Here's my, you know, and I think every artist gets to a certain point and they maybe kind of slow down or stop at a certain kind of era, you know. And it's funny when I'll reference an artist or, you know, show an artist, and I'll have a student say, oh, well, I wasn't even really born then. So then it's a matter of kind of keeping myself, you know, up to speed. So I thought, well, what about within these pieces, are there these placards, you know, and they're shaped that they look like they have multiple functions. Sometimes they hang off a piece, they're stacked on the floor. And again, it's like, how do you present truths? How do you present like an iconic image or an educational image or just a mysterious image or a specimen? I had the great fortune of working at the Field Museum in Chicago, and I was always fascinated just by how objects were presented, kind of in their singularity, but also as a cultural representation, but then also how they were tagged, how they were labeled, how they were identified, you know, how the lineage of these objects, you know, was discovered. And I remember it's like, wow, once that front glass goes on the case, you know, there's a little, that's truth, right? That's what we're supposed to understand as real and factual and research. And it's, you know, it can be a fiction, you know, it can be a narrative that's held by the owner of these objects. And so I think hopefully there's enough familiarity with that kind of shape or that kind of, you know, placard. And it also, yeah, I think of placards as, you know, points of, you know, revolution. I mean, I think of the, you know, I am a man placard, you know, or all these different things that have very, you know, intentional, pointed, you know, sort of political moves or social moves attached to them. But, you know, what if they're more personal? You know, what if it's a, you know, a collection of my own, you know, bizarre iconographies or forms that I continue to use? What does that mean when I represent those? You know, is it a representation of myself? Is it a surrogate self? Is it all these sort of different things? And then placeholder, I think of, again, are all these pieces variations of me? Are they my odd little stunt doubles? You know, are they placeholders for, you know, desires or fantasies or recollections or regrets, all these other kind of factors.
Yeah. Thank you for that. So the first piece I would like to talk about on the show is called Quite Quite, and it is also on the gallery flyers as sure. Well. Like materials, And I also, you mentioned earlier that the materials, you try to put as many materials in the show as possible. And I kind of, I got that when I saw the show as well. And I'm curious what each piece and materials and performance and how all of they, like each one, what they represent and what you're talking about and everything.
The show card piece, I was really excited about. Quite comes from a Jean Genet novel, Our Lady of the Flowers. And I swear I have to read that book once a year, just to, I mean, I joke with my husband, I got to keep up on my high faggotry, because the book is so good, and it, you know, just, I don't know if you know the story, it was written in prison by Jean Genet, and it's this whole fantasy construction of these queens, you know, tricking with sailors and politicians in the town, and I love the fact that within the book, there's this whole sub language that they use, and quite comes from, you know, they would be like, oh, isn't she quite the fabulous? Isn't she quite the thing? And then it just eventually reduced down to one of the main characters just being called quite. So it was reduced. And I just love that idea of this, you know, these are marginalized communities or communities that need to, you know, sort of build their own symbology and their language and the coded language that crisscrosses between, you know, activities. And then I thought, well, let's make it both a little beautiful, a little horrific. You know, within that piece, there's adornment, the kind of odd turban-like puffy upholstered headpiece, if it's a headpiece. I mean, I guess it's a headpiece because hair's coming out of it, right? But there's also embedded within the piece, you know, a wrapping. Is that reparative? Is that a bandage? Is that from violence? Is that from self-inflicted violence? All these things start to pile into that. And then the sort of bulbous, amorphous form, there's a self-adornment. There's a little necklace wrapped around this odd little squash-like bulb. So hopefully it does that dance between, you know, hell yeah, here I am, you know, lumps, bumps, scars and all, with a certain sort of pride, you know, and none of this sort of physicality denied, none of this, you know, potential sexuality denied as well.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, I love getting little mirrors at Joanne's fabrics. They're super cheap. And
yeah, I noticed there are a lot of mirrors throughout the whole show.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about that material specifically right now, we can do that too. What does the mirror represent? Like, when I go through the show, it's really fun because I, as a viewer, can go in and put myself into the piece and see myself and also my environment too. And it's like a little dance that the viewer has to do in order to like get to see themselves.
Yeah. I think it's about that. I think it's another way to continually break that that sort of passive wall. Oh, I can sit here and look at this piece. You know, I choose the gap, I choose the distance to engage with it. But if all of a sudden you're conscious of the piece, you know, almost literally looking back at you, or even more interesting, a couple of the pieces, the mirrors don't really focus back down on the viewer. They're kind of looking at another area of the gallery, or maybe even at another piece. So again, you know, it's kind of a little trickery to, you know, both, like you said, engage the viewer and make them a little more implicit in what's happening. Also, just a reflection back, which reminds the viewer, oh, you are actually viewing a little bit of artifice, so don't also take it too seriously. I mean, not that they're funhouse mirrors, but they have that same kind of like, oh, I'm present in this moment looking at this piece, and it's looking at me, or it's looking, or it's ignoring me, it's looking around me, or up in the other sort of corner. And I think it's also just a really formally, it's a really interesting way to break, you know, to sort of break a surface, you know, and introduce a little, you know, shiny bit, a little bit of a bling. But it's more about having the piece kind of look back, and also, you know, surveillance, voyeurism, you know, all those things start to appear anytime there's a reflection back, or, you know, who else is looking in the mirror to see down, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hi, you are listening to KBOO-FM, and this is this week's Art Focus with guest host Kristen Derryberry. Today we are speaking with David Eckert. The current show, Placards and Placeholders, is up now until February 15th at PCC Sylvania's Northview Gallery. The gallery hours are from 8 to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday and 11 to 4 p.m. on Saturday. We're just going to continue our conversation talking about specific pieces in the show.
Okay.
The next one up is Fossils, Whispers, and Revolution. And that was the first one, or the back one in the gallery. that you had a sort of walk around and see.
Yeah. There's a central carved sort of figure or emblem or emblematic shape. Mm-hmm. And then around that, there's a series of placards that hang around its base. The sort of structural form, I had a friend say, oh, it kind of looks like an old Parisian umbrella stand. And, you know, and initially I'm like, oh, that's kind of odd. But that's like, no, that's actually perfect because I want them to carry that sense of utility. And so this piece, you know, again, I think of like, what are our, you know, this sounds really sort of heavy handed, but like, who are our gods? Who are our images? What are our icons that we revere or pray to or challenge? And so there's this odd central shape, which I kind of reference as the fossil. It's like, you know, what histories does it carry? Can I embed it with my own sort of narrative? And there's a little handle on it, so you can actually turn it. So, you know, how is it presented? You know, and again, I think of when reliquary or icons come out of storage or come out of, you know, the church or paraded through the street and all those kind of things. You know, what is a personal object like that look like? And then around the base, again, playing with the idea of these placards, it's like there's three images that are quite ambiguous. One looks like a busted up ring. One is looks like a drawing, a variation of the shape drawn on a piece of paper. And then this stick, you know, basically a stick. And I like to keep these shapes and these forms fairly neutral, because then in combination, hopefully, you know, a narrative starts to form or associations start to form. But also in the back of these, instead of them just being, you know, sort of static placards, there's a little leather strap and a part of it that has two holes. So I thought, well, again, Fossil Whispers Revolution, could these placards be taken off this rack and taken into the street for demands of, you know, fill in the blank, what kind of demand you want, what kind of, you know, action you want. So again, it's like this static, condensed little, almost like a little activist piece, but again, what's being challenged or what's being called for is ambiguous. You know, and again, it goes back to that, you know, over the years that I've built this series and collections of forms and shapes and, you know, associative materials, it's like, is this my little, you know, activist station, you know? And then, you know, I don't know what I'm actually demanding, but I like that idea. Again, people can navigate that piece and be like, well, what's being asked of me or what's being expected of me, you know? And then again, the little hints of function, hopefully, you know, force that conversation a little tighter. It's like, well, if I was to pick this up, what would that even mean? You know, who am I showing this to? Am I turning it back to myself? Is this a moment of contemplation or of action?
Yeah, I felt that piece particularly challenged me as a viewer in a way that I got stuck on one side, and then finally I went to move on to another piece, but I, like, turned, and I had to go back. So in that way, it, like, challenged, especially in the placement in the gallery, I think, too. It was a very smart decision to put it kind of in the back, surrounded by the other pieces, so it does that challenge of a revisit, almost.
Yeah, and I'm very excited about that piece because it was, again, one of the later pieces in the show. And also, I just took on I've never really carved, you know, anything. And I was like, oh, let's give that a try. What does it mean when some of the forms that I've been drawing for years start to become actualized as actual form? You know, does that shift their intention? Are they lessened because they're actually real? You know, is it more potent to look in an image that you have to kind of suspend what you know and kind of step through that conceptual plane? What is it when it's presented as this iconic form? And it's an odd form. I mean, I had a lot of people say, oh, it's a rooster weather vane, or it looks like the hammer of the eardrum bone, or it looks like some bad 60s abstract Virgin and Mary, you know, two sort of figures. And I'm like, there's been some also more vulgar responses to what it might possibly be with a double sort of syndrome, you know. But I think that's absolutely fine. You know, and my biggest fear and the thing I'm always trying to be conscious of is, you know, how opaque can these forms and images be before they just become nonsense or before they don't have enough relatable associative quality that you just go, oh, that's his shtick. I don't know what this is, you know, sort of moving on. So that's the dance I'm always trying to do of, like, sort of seduce, start the conversation, or, you know, pose that riddle, and then sort of step back. Because the last thing I want is that sort of didactic, this is the piece, next. But allow that room for inquisition and questioning.
Yeah. Next, I want to talk about you mentioned earlier your earliest or your newest piece, Cornucopia Theatrics of Worth.
Yes.
I just want you to talk about that. Give it a shot.
I'll give it a shot because it is still like, who made this piece and what's it doing in here? You know, since it was freed from the studio. Again, with this show and, you know, earlier work too, I'm really enjoying the interplay between these structural forms and then these illusionary panels, you know, whether the placards or shaped forms, like with Quite Quiet, it's a very specific sort of shaped form, specific to me. In this piece, I really wanted to see what happens when more of the structure is apparent. And even if there's a sculpted, you know, moment, this welded steel shape, that again implies sort of a function. You know, it looks like some old scientific device or some very specific, like an astrolabe. Do you look at the stars through this thing? Do you look through this orifice aperture in the front? Even if you do that, you look through that, there's a false dimensionality. It looks like some kid's diorama, but it's a little, I guess, needier than that. But then again, you look through that whole thing, there's a little mirror embedded in the very end of the sort of frontal device. So again, you're looking through, it's looking back at you. There's a whole sense of balance in it as well. There's a sandbag that keeps it in this kind of point of stasis. But if it gets bumped, it moves a little bit. It kind of animates itself a little bit. There's a handle that comes off to the side that implies maybe another function. It's like, what does this device do? How many people does it take to activate it? And if it's activated, what does that actually mean? So again, the cornucopia more from sort of the shape of one of the central components, you know, but also cornucopia of like, oh, it's a horn of plenty. It's here's excess. Here's, the idea of, you know, excess amount of things. And then, you know, the sort of theatrics of worth is like, well, how do we judge worth, both in self and a piece of work? And, you know, for me, the idea of worth is like, well, this thing contains itself, it carries itself, it presents itself, it has balance, it has constructed itself, or I've constructed it to have this, you know, sort of cohesive identity. Again, the identity is elusive, and again, it's a super, super new piece, so a month from now I can say, aha, now I understand what this thing is. But I think it's, again, just continuing to pursue that exploration of image and objects and structures that support images, you know, the realness of an object that you have to kind of contend with your body, but then, oh, within that there's also this illusionary space that's trying to bring me someplace else. So I love that kind of dance.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That was a really good synthesis for the first go around talking about that piece. Next, I would want to talk about Cottage, Bishop, and Sailor, which was the fabric piece with the painting.
Yeah, so. This one, it's always a situation, and, you know, I've had friends joke with me, it's like, do you really want to talk about the real source of this work? Because a lot of time it's so base, and it's so kind of primal, and it's kind of wrong, and it's fetishy. So this piece, if anybody knows what cottage means or cottaging means, it's actually the British term for like gay public sex in like restrooms. Mm-hmm. So if you start looking at the piece, all of a sudden embedded in it with these two forms, which I kind of assume Bishop and Sailor. It kind of comes from Jean Genet to Our Lady of the Flowers a little bit, mm-hmm. but it also just comes from a, you know, very sort of specific queer cultural practice that, you know, shifts in and out of its heyday or whatever. Yeah. But also within that, too, I wanted to build this sort of grand, over-the-top sort of theatrics. You know, I sort of made the joke about quite and Jean Genet with this sort of high faggotry idea. And I say that with all the love in the world. And this piece is similar. And you start looking through the imagery there, all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait a minute, the wall, that gray wall that these figures, these amorphous figures are kind of engaged with, looks a lot like a bathroom stall. Oh, there's a little bit of graffiti on there. And so again, it's like the quite language. If you kind of know what cottage means, or if you kind of start making these recognitions, you might start to understand, say, oh, it seems like there's a hole cut through this wall, and there's a ring, and there's a piece of cloth stuffed into one of the rings. And then, but I like sort of dressing it out in its excessive, you know, what I see is like the bishop figure has these big, weird, bulbous green sort of forms. There's a necklace that goes around its, like, his neck. And then there's these other sort of white ghost-like forms that are behind the quote-unquote, you know, sort of bishop figure. And then even within those, like around their collars, I guess if they would have collars, there's these series of these coded colors and coded patterns. And that code comes directly from the handkerchief code, like from the 70s on, you know, in the queer community, of ways to literally sort of flag desires. You know, the red handkerchief in the left pocket, the red handkerchief, that means certain things. And it's amazing. I always have on my, in my studio wall a printout of that. And it gets incredibly specific. So it's like pink and yellow paisley on a red ground means, and then fill in whatever sort of fetish you can kind of imagine. And again, I love that. That's the idea of this coded secret language, and then to be able to use it, whether you know it or not, as a way for me to make color choices. I've used it a lot over the years, you know, because a lot of times, like, well, what color should that be? And it's like, oh, let's just go to a source that I can reference, and whether it's known or not doesn't matter, but it gives me a chance to keep the colors and the color choices from just falling into, like, a habit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then again, with the, mm-hmm. you know, there's a the sort of white, almost like bone-like forms that are embedded in the painting, but then there's one that kind of floats off of a little structure, and that structure holds a big swag of fabric that just falls, you know, to the ground. So again, you know, operatic, mm-hmm. over the top.
Yeah. Theatrics.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
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 Lastly, I would like to talk about Knuckle.
Okay.
If you can just talk about that, and we can just wrap up.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that piece was, and again, I had, you know, I was in a real great sort of studio mode, just producing. And that was going to be a component in this larger installation of the swags and ropes and balances and cantilevers, and, you know, it felt like fountains and mini ponies. I couldn't stop. And then I was just started rendering the main sort of flat form. And then I thought, oh, this needs like a tail, or this needs that break of the two-dimension to a three-dimension. And so I put the hair, the fake hair in it. And then I let myself stop, which is pretty rare, to sort of edit back. And I thought, well, that's enough. It's kind of carrying all the social, you know, it's both fist, hand, you know, other body parts. You know, it's very, very orificial, if that's a word.
Yeah.
It is orifice-like.
Yeah.
You know, but then with the hair, and then again with hair, it's such a complex thing. It's like, you always hear the line, hair is beautiful until it's off the body. You know, hair is beautiful until you see it on your soap or if it's on the sink. And so that idea, again, of it's sort of seductive, you know, it's preening and sort of presenting itself, but it's also naked.
Yeah.
In a certain way.
Yeah, it must be satisfying to distill some ideas in such a simple piece, too.
Yeah.
And that's always great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming on. And, any, just keep us posted with any future plans.
I certainly will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, have a good one.
Thank you so much.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series, featuring Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, an ensemble from the worlds of jazz and folk music. The show is Friday, February 21st, 7:30 p.m., at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Sam Ryder has been a U.S. State Department musical ambassador, taking his accordion to at least six nations. For 6 years, Ryder has been band leader for Jazz at the Lincoln Center's youth program. The Human Hands feature the violin stylings of Oregonian Alex Hargraves. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. We are almost at the noon hour, and we want to let you know that we appreciate your support of KBOO and encourage you to become a sustaining member of KBOO by contributing on a recurring monthly basis. Monthly memberships of just a few dollars a month are easy to set up, and they provide KBOO with the most secure and stable funding to help pay our bills and keep the great music, news, and public affairs coming to you throughout the year. Monthly giving also cuts down on the number of membership drives we need to have each year. For more information on how you can become a sustaining member of KBOO, go to kboo.fm/give or give us a call at 503-231-8032. As always, we appreciate your support. Thank you. And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the noon news report and followed by Buscando America. So stay tuned.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
It's what, midnight? And we don't know the results, and the Democratic Party hasn't been really clear about what the, quote, inconsistencies are.
Iowa Democrat Ed Vallon responding to last night's anticlimactic end to almost a year of Iowa campaigning. Results from the Iowa caucuses are coming out today. Last night, issues with a new reporting app prompted the Iowa Democratic Party to go back through the cards on which Iowans expressed their support, taking much more time than expected with the app. Iowa community political blogger Laura Bellin caucused in a suburb of Des Moines, which she called, quote, an older suburban neighborhood, unquote.
I was expecting a little bit higher turnout. Our turnout was a little bit higher than 2016, but not at the level of 2008, which was the record for Democratic caucuses here. So I was expecting the turnout to hit closer to that 2008 level. From what I've seen anecdotally, I haven't seen any numbers, big numbers from the state party, but anecdotally it seems like there was a lot of variability. Turnout was very high in some of the college town precincts. In some of the precincts more in the city of Des Moines near the urban core, the turnout seems to have been very high.